I'm Scott Hansen, host of NFL Red Zone. Lowe's knows Sundays hit different when you earn them. We've got you covered with outdoor power equipment from Kobalt and everything you need to weatherproof your deck with Trex decking. Plus, with lawn care from Scotts and, of course, Pit Boss grills and accessories, you can get a home field advantage all season long. So get to Lowe's, get it done, and earn your Sunday. Lowe's, official partner of the NFL.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary. With Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
When you're winning a record 8 world titles in a row, it would be easy to take success for granted.
Everything we did was trying to goad ourselves to remember that it would be complacency that got us, hubris that finished us. Very fearful that we would, lacking the sting of defeat, would not be turning over the rocks that would be necessary to stay strong. And we were able to sort of slay loads of the complacency dragons, but you don't have to make many mistakes before they'll get you. And this one had quite a big impact on it.
The dominant force in Formula One before Red Bull's recent renaissance, Mercedes have fallen behind in recent years. But after scoring their first pole and podium of the season in Canada, technical director James Allison is hopeful they've finally made a long-term breakthrough.
If we can get ourselves back to a place where we are genuinely properly competitive across a whole wide range of circuits and we're in the championship battle, I know that the pleasure we will collectively feel will make all the last 3 years, the pain and the self-doubt and the self-loathing in some instances, will make all of that just go away like dew, you know, as the sun comes out.
Hello and welcome to F1 Beyond the Grid with me, Tom Clarkson. James Allison is a winner. During his impressive career at the sharp end of Formula One, he's contributed to 27 drivers' and constructors' titles, so we can only imagine just how frustrating the last few years have been for him. Because since the current ground effect cars were introduced a couple of years ago, Mercedes have had a tough time, and last season was their first without a single victory in 12 years. But George Russell's pole and podium in Montreal felt like a turning point. And in this chat, James talks us through the team's recent progress. He also explains why they were dumb not to see a solution sooner. James is always articulate, and to hear him describe the impact that underperformance had on him and the team's well-being is very powerful. We also talk about Lewis Hamilton and what James will miss about the seven-time champion, and we discuss how his relationship with team principal Toto Wolff has evolved, and much, much more. I hope you enjoy our conversation. James, great to have you on the show again. How are things?
Things are all right, thank you. And it's a pleasure to be here.
Well, given the pace of the car in Canada, have we got you on the show at the start of what I'd like to call a Mercedes renaissance?
No. I think you've got us on the show 3 races into something that has been a progressively improving car. It just happens that we've put it on pole at this quite unusual track. But I think that the things that have given us that opportunity have been coming for a few races. They're just rather unheralded when you're close but no cigar.
There have been glimmers of hope all season, but the performance then falls away when it matters. So what has changed with the car?
Well, I think that the thing that has bedeviled us from the start of the year, the overriding thing, was that you could get the car okay in a slow corner, get it quite decent in a fast corner, but you couldn't get it good in both at the same time. What has changed in the last 2-3 races is that we've modified the car in such a way as it actually has a reasonable high to low speed balance and a reasonable through corner balance. But those are sort of boringy, jargony things that it just means that the driver can trust both the front and rear axle in a fast corner and a slow corner and can trust it from when he hits the brakes at the beginning of the corner all the way through the apex and out the other side. That balance is crucial to a driver, that they know whether the car is going to understeer or oversteer and that it's going to follow the trajectory they're asking.
We're 2.5 years into these rule changes. So was it one eureka moment where someone came to you and said, James, this is what we need to do, or was it more incremental gains?
Eureka moments are ones where you joyfully understand something that I guess no one has understood before, and you've advanced knowledge in the process, and that's, I think, a very wonderful thing. This is more of a, oh God, how could we have been so dumb type moment where you see the path forward and you should have seen it sooner.
Can we investigate that a little bit more? I mean, this all is the front wing, is it, that George ran for the first time in Monaco?
Yeah, that's the one of the bigger things about it, yeah. And it's all just trying to figure out how to get the car to go high and low speed in a good way and to go through a corner in a good way. And a thing that we'd been fighting all year with springs and bars and all the mechanical accoutrements on the car, just attacking it with the aerodynamic characteristic of the car.
So, I mean, I'm quoting you now, but why had you been so dumb?
I think it's quite easy to get distracted by things that are side problems rather than the main problem, to allow yourself the indulgence that if we just sort out that little thing, then we'll be okay. And so we worked on things that did actually make the car better, but weren't the fundamental problem.
Does this raise the question about the budget cap?
No, it doesn't. No, it's not a budget cap thing.
But would you have got there faster without a budget cap?
No, I don't think so.
So it's an ideas thing?
Yeah, it was just ensuring that you're not just chasing downforce, say, but you're also got car handling higher enough in the priorities of what you're doing.
Well, George Russell, after his pole position in Canada, was saying, we've found the path forward now. So do you think you can be competitive at every racetrack going forward?
I think that we definitely can get the car this season to be properly competitive and to fear no tracks. I think that the specifics of this circuit might make our fans think prematurely that we're already there. This circuit has quite a low range of cornering speeds in it, and it tests the car maybe slightly less severely than some of the others that are coming up. And while I'm pretty sure that we will make a good showing in the nearby future races, I'd be surprised if we're on pole at the next one, for example. But I am absolutely certain that we can be as fast as anybody over the coming period.
Now, it's been a tough period to get to this point. And I'd like to quote Niki Lauda now, who has always said, you learn more when you lose than when you win. Do you agree with him?
Yes, I do. I think on balance, it forces you to look under every rock when you've got the sting of defeat. And it's quite easy to misattribute your success to your collective skill and cleverness rather than good fortune. And defeat forces you to face all your weaknesses in a way that's very cathartic and painful, but ultimately very good for a team.
So if we were to extrapolate Nicky's theory a bit further, have you been paying the price for all that success from 2014 to 2021?
I think in some ways, yes. In other ways, a little bit unlucky in places. But I think the most significant thing that I would say we could point to inwards at ourselves and say as a criticism is that the way that we had found of working in the previous set of rules was very effective for the previous set of rules. And I don't just mean like, you know, the way we'd shape the front wing or the particular way that we handled the tire squirt at the rear of the car. I mean that the way the key engineering groups interacted with one another in the team, so the aerodynamics with vehicle dynamics with the track and track with both of those two groups, the way that we were set up in the old world worked just fine. And not just fine, it worked for 8 seasons on the trot, something no one has ever done before. It was pretty impressive. But we, to a large extent, carried on with that way of working together under different circumstances and were insufficiently self-critical to recognize that there were weaknesses inherent in that approach in the new world that didn't matter in the old. Yeah, we definitely paid a price for that.
Why does the new world require a different way of working?
Mostly because the cars are all so uncomfortably near to the ground in this set of rules that suspension and aerodynamics have to be really, really, really tightly bound up with one another. And in the old world, they sort of were, you know, they needed to be cousins, but they didn't need to be really, really properly embedded in each other's worlds. And actually, it would have been inefficient in the old world to spend time fretting about the interaction of one group on the other in a particularly intense way, because they were sort of orthogonal to each other to some extent. Now they are just completely in bed, and the interaction has to be very tight.
So without even knowing it, does complacency set in when you are dominating?
Yes, but I think you know that as well. You know, I was lucky enough to join Mercedes in 2017. So the third year there's of the dominance that subsequently unfolded, and I joined a team that was already very, very aware that it would be complacency that killed us. Everything we did over the time from before I joined and thereafter was trying to goad ourselves to remember that it would be complacency that got us, hubris that finished us, and very fearful that we would, lacking the sting of defeat, would not be turning over the rocks that would be necessary to stay strong. And I think it is massively to the credit of the team that for 8 years managed to keep that going and successfully faced down enormous tranches of what complacency, that the manner in which complacency can kill you. You know, I think you have to give huge credit to Toto for keeping the ship on an even keel across that period. It is really hard to keep a good team together, and jealousies arise and frictions arise and internecine sort of nastiness arise. You know, that's nothing technical at all, but that normally kills a team long before they make a technical mistake. And that was a real strength, and still remains a real strength in our team. And we were able to sort of slay loads of the complacency dragons, but you know, it's a tough sport and you don't have to make many mistakes before they'll get you. And this one of not recognizing the interactions necessary between aero and suspension, suspension and track, has had quite a big impact on us.
That blind spot you refer to, how much of a role did you stepping away for 2 years play in that? Because you became chief technical officer from mid-21 to, well, mid-23. And that does coincide with the dip in form.
Yeah, but I think coincidentally rather than causally, it would have been much the same had I been in my old role during that time. And indeed, you know, we managed to continue this mistake into the start of this year with me back in the role that I'd enjoyed previously. So I don't think it's that I would have made a substantial difference. I hope that having had whatever the opposite or the sort of shadow cousin of a eureka moment is, that I've been helpful in engaging the factory and all the folk who make this work to say, I know we've had lots of false starts, but believe me, this is worth a push. This will make a big difference. And the response of the factory to that has just been absolutely brilliant. And the relief in them at seeing that their efforts, which have been tremendous, their efforts are finally being rewarded by judgments that were actually correct, and the car responding, is that's been the happiest thing about the last 2-3 races. Is you had the moment where you go, oh God, and then you know, or we collectively knew what to ask for, and then the factory could not have responded more magnificently to it.
So much was made over the last 2 years of the zero side pod concept. If you'd put the front wing that you have now on that car, or an iteration of it, would that car have worked?
Well, I wouldn't get too hung up on focused on the front wing. You know, the front wing is part of an overall package, but the behavior that we've managed to embed into the car over the last 2 or 3 races, of which the front wing is a component, has helped make us get a bit more on terms with the people that are doing a decent job. The whole hoopla about side pods is just flotsam and jetsam, really. It's the sport often focuses on what a car looks like, on, you know, whether it has X or Y thing on it, whether it's running high ride heights, low ride heights. Observers of the sport are utterly confused. Why would a team pigheadedly do something that's visually different when it's so obvious what the right thing to do is? It's understandable that that's how they feel, and their confusion is understandable. But if a team is incorrectly placing value on stuff at the analytical level, then you will get the wrong geometry at the far side. And there's no point in putting someone else's geometry on the car, because your method of valuing it will immediately iterate you away from it back to what you previously valued. You have to understand what to value. And if you understand what to value, the geometry will pop out on its own. The challenge is understanding what to place value on. And I think quite often in the sport, you can be trundling along, having a lot of success, as we did previously, largely because we were placing value on the right things. But the fact that we were on that happy road, we might clap ourselves on the back and say how clever we were, but actually there's a certain amount of good fortune to it. And the cleverness was only on making sure we stayed on that road and adapted it left or right a little as the rules tweaked left or right a little over those years. And that the cleverness too was trying to keep this team who had won so much operating with hunger to keep winning more. But the road that you were going down, the things we chose to value, that they were the correct ones, an amount of that is serendipity. Just as I would hold that when the torch passed to Red Bull at the changing of these regulations, they will rightfully deserve the success they've earned. But a certain amount of it will be that it will have come to them, that they will have found themselves on a good path under these new rules, and now they just need the wit to stay on it. Now, that might be doing them a disservice. Maybe they absolutely calculated everything utterly perfectly, and they did, you know, and it's the result of their individual brilliance. But the experience of the last few years for my team would suggest that there is an amount of fortune and then a larger slice of merit based on your ability to stay on that path, however you arrived at it.
When it comes to showing appreciation, the gift you choose says everything. Minky Couture luxury blankets make the perfect statement. Soft, stylish, and unforgettable. Whether you're thanking a client, rewarding an employee, or celebrating a milestone, nothing delivers warmth and gratitude like a Minky blanket. With custom options and elegant packaging, your gift will stand out and be remembered long after the moment has passed. Make your corporate gifting extraordinary with Minky Couture, luxury you can feel. Visit minkycouture.com to get started.
James, you've won a lot in your career, obviously with Mercedes, but with two stints at Ferrari as well. Does the fortune thing carry to that previous success as well, when you were with Michael Schumacher, Ross Brawn, Rory Byrne?
I'll answer that at two levels. The fortune of winning a lot very much depends on the fortune of whether you have been lucky to be employed by a team that was in shape to win. You know, I got sacked from Benetton in 1999 and wound up at Ferrari largely because people at Benetton previously, who were then at Ferrari, remembered me as a sort of an okay person. And I then pitched up at Ferrari just at the beginning of their fabulous run of victories and rode along on the coattails of that. That's just pure fortune at a personal level. If you then sort of take a step back and say, was Ferrari's success utterly merited, or was there any good fortune in it? We at the time had the deserved results of having employed the best driver of the day, Michael. The team had the best budget of the day, because Jean had successfully argued for that from the higher-ups and on the Ferrari board. And we had a brilliant technical director who had the wisdom to sort of keep a strong team together. But there would have been elements of luck in what the team chose to place value on in wind tunnels and in suspension design. It's just they put some of the big fundamentals in place that improve their chances massively.
I'm sensing, talking to you, that what's happened in the last three races is a bit of a relief. Is that fair?
No, that's massively understating it. We exist for one purpose, and that is to arrive at tracks with cars capable of competing, not just for races, but for championships. And we've fallen short of that. And, you know, that's our entire professional purpose. You know, we spend far more time at work than we do at home. And if the car is not where it should be, there's no one to blame except yourself. Understanding and mending that, as that starts to move in the right direction, there is enormous satisfaction and enormous relief. Because when the car isn't good, every single member of that team, to some degree or other, will have their entire life colored by, you know, the position on a leaderboard of that carbon and titanium and aluminium thing. It will determine whether you enjoy your holidays, how happy you are with your family, whether you sleep, how much food you eat. You know, it colors every aspect of your life, because you can't put it out of your mind until it's on a good path. So it's far more than relief. It's just a completely inescapable part of your life that has to be good in order for things to be good.
The buck stops with you. So how tough has it been?
I don't want to over exaggerate that, because toughness sort of implies that, you know, you're looking for sympathy or anything, which is not the case. It's a challenging job. It asks a lot of you. You definitely feel the weight of it, but there's an aspect of all of that challenge that I haven't described, which is you feel the privilege of it too, especially when you're losing. And when you walk in the door in the morning and you know that you are playing a part in trying to make sure that all of us don't have all of those difficult feelings, but that we start to see how we can maneuver our way out of it. The privilege of that is enormous. That is what actually makes the difficulty bearable. And then right in the very back of your head is the more than hope, but the certainty that if we act in the correct way together and we keep doing it for long enough, then we will be back on the top step of the podium, and everything, all of this will be worthwhile. However sort of pathetic that sounds, because, you know, at a sort of global level, if aliens were watching us, they say, well, why does it matter at all? But it does. And the payoff when you as a team, with all your colleagues who've felt all of those feelings, have managed to, by hook or by crook, you know, put to one side all the doubters who are slinging arrows at you from outside, and collectively worked studiously and with merit to bring it back to a good place, that final payoff does make it worthwhile. And actually, the glory of the sport and the glory of being involved in it is that that final payout is meaningful only because it's so bloody difficult, and because you have all of this passion behind it and all of this stress behind it and sometimes misery behind it. That has to be there for the prize to be worth it.
So that privilege that you've just described, is that the reason you wanted to come back as technical director?
It was a big part of it, yes. It is thrilling to feel properly embedded in a team. It's even more thrilling to be granted the honor of having a position of leadership in a team, and to know that when we collectively have taken the right moves, that you were there and standing up and being counted on the difficult sort of days that we've been talking about. That is very, very, very invigorating and gives professional satisfaction in a way that I imagine would be very hard to find in most jobs.
How had the job of technical director changed in the 2 years that you'd been away?
I don't think particularly fundamentally. We moved as a team from a phase of trying to just keep that unbroken run unbroken to it being broken and being in a build back phase, and to be trying to give people the faith that this was going to come good, and therefore a much more sort of needing to find a sort of buoyant but realistic leadership style in a period where there'd be lots of reason to sort of think, well, do you know what, maybe it's time to leave this team and go somewhere else.
I'm probably putting two and two together and making five, but that balance you've just talked about, the headlines of, you know, brain drains at Mercedes, do you think other teams are paying people more than Mercedes? Is that a contributing factor to all of the staff movements that have gone on?
I think that it probably pays to recognize what a sort of full frontal war Formula One is. And the war of trying to make your car competitive is fought on every front. And so it is convenient for certain teams who have brain drains of their own to put narratives in the press about the sort of misfortunes that others might be suffering. And actually, our team is not particularly affected in a way that you might imagine if you were to read the motor racing press. We have people join, we have people leave, and there's a sort of equilibrium between that. If there weren't, our team would be just getting smaller. We have lost some very good people. We've gained some very good people. And 'twas ever thus in the sport. The stuff that you read in the press is ordinarily things that other teams are briefing to distract attention from themselves. I haven't felt in our team that we are suffering as a result of the sort of large-scale movement of talent. I've just felt the continuing, ongoing fight that you have in this sport for good people to be at your team and giving them reasons to want to be at your team. We pay competitively in the pit lane, and that's not a problem.
James, tell us a little bit more about your relationship with Toto. How's it changed since 2017 when you joined?
Well, we didn't know one another when we started. We know one another very well now as a result of working together all that time. We've been through a massive amount together. We know each other's strengths and each other's weaknesses. And I'd say that in good times or in bad, the thing that has made that relationship one that for me has been really a very enjoyable thing is that of the big bosses I've worked for, Toto is the one who has the self-confidence to cope with the fact that I'm quite outspoken. I don't worry about the effect of what I'm saying will be on my career. I just try to say what I think's important. And that can be quite direct and difficult to hear sometimes. And Toto has been very, very generous in letting me say those things and being able to argue them out with me without getting bent out of shape over it, to just have the debate and reach a new point of where either we agree to disagree or I may have moved him slightly or I've been moved towards his position. But it's been a relationship that hasn't been blighted by him feeling like, oh, he's threatening me or you know, this is a challenge to my authority. As long as we do it sort of away from the public eye, this has been a brilliant thing about working for him.
What is the structure inside the team? Are you his 2IC, for want of a better description?
No, I don't think so. Toto is the team principal, CEO, managing director, you know, the top dog in the team, unquestioned. He owns a third of it and he runs all of it. But he has a management committee of extremely strong folk in the CFO, the COO, the chief people officer, the chief communications officer, and I'm one of that group. And we as a group hack around a load of stuff together in Toto's absence, and then we then discuss things in his presence. And I think Toto leans on that whole layer pretty equally, because all parts of that have to function for the team to function. It's just from the outside, people imagine teams are just engineering and drivers and the race team, but it's way broader than that. And you need a whole team of folk at the management level for a team to function well.
So it functions well. And was it a no-brainer for you to re-sign like you did last winter, or did you shop around a bit?
Not a no-brainer, because when you choose to stay in the role that is as much fun as the one I enjoy, you are necessarily saying no to a whole heap of other stuff. You're saying no to being at home, kicking around with family who you love, I'm lucky enough to have a granddaughter now and another grandchild on the way. And the decision to stay is necessarily a decision to spend less time with those people who you would dearly love to be around more. So it isn't a no-brainer, but on balance, it was something that I wanted to do. And I happily got the sort of assent of Chloe, my partner, and my children, that it was a worthwhile exchange.
Let's talk drivers now, if we could. George has outqualified Lewis 8-1 so far this year. Okay, the gap between them is very small, rarely more than a tenth of a second. But does that stat surprise you?
Yeah, I wouldn't have predicted 8-1. And I think that for a chunk of the year, the car has been a pretty troubled beast. It's become a much, much better car in the last two or three races. And with that, I think the judgments about who may and may not put it in front of the other car become more meaningful because the car is less of a random number generator. But, you know, Lewis has not by accident been the best qualifier in the history of the sport because I think he's been the best driver in the sport. But he's struggling to make it stick this year by fine margins, as you say. And I think to a degree, I was speculating this in an email I sent to the factory yesterday, that the current car tire combo, not just us, across the pit lane, it doesn't like being hustled. You almost get the best lap times when you're not trying. And you see every weekend, you'll see someone pop a lap time in free practice or in qualifying in some session or other. You'll see some car and you think, well, how did that get there? And then they don't do it again. It disappears in the mist straight after. And I think in qualifying, it's quite hard where you're all pumped up and you're wanting to get the best from it to do a lap that is sort of relaxed enough to get the best out of the car.
Is that why you think neither driver improved on new tyres in Canada?
My opinion, yes. I mean, it may be that the track was a little worse at the end. We were running a little later than the others. But I think that last push, that sort of final heave, I don't think the car likes it.
Yeah. But do you think George has taken a step up this year? Do you think he's reacted well to the news that Lewis Hamilton is leaving?
I think he's very, very consistent at getting the car at its best in qualifying trim. And he's really good at that. I think it's much more even in the race. And Lewis's race pace has been very strong relative to George on a number of occasions this year. But in qualifying, George has definitely had the better of it.
Lewis said in Monaco, didn't he, that he doesn't expect to out-qualify George for the rest of the year, I think he said. There are so many ways to interpret what he's just said. What's your take on it?
Well, I think if you just look at the stats, 8-1, then maybe, well, it was 7-1 back then, but maybe it would be reasonable to think if that trend continues, there won't be many times when he'll be on pole. I think that if you try and read into that stuff that isn't there, like there's somehow he's got a systematic disadvantage on qualifying day, that's not true and not fair. So far as we can make it, the cars are identical. The engine use is identical. If the cars are different on setup, it's because that's what the driving engineering team on either side of the garage have iterated to, but they have the chance to have identical stuff if they chose. On one occasion this year, and famously in Monaco, they had a different front wing on the car because we only had one available, and we took the decision that we would get that wing on the car as soon as we could, and it had to go to one or other. And we had a conversation and Lewis said, now let George have it.
James, there's been a recurring theme from Hamilton this year saying that his feeling in the car goes away during qualifying.
If you come back to emphasize that it's my hypothesis that the cars don't like being hustled, that they give you the best lap time when the driver is surprised by the lap time. Be interesting, you talk up and down the pit lane and see whether this is an experience elsewhere, but when the car is producing good laps, the drivers are almost like, you know, I wasn't expecting that. I was almost cruising. And when it's qualifying and it's sort of the pressure's on and it's time to deliver, I don't think those are the circumstances that get the best from quite fussy tyres.
Talking of surprises, how surprised were you when you heard that Lewis wanted to leave the team?
Not massively. I was surprised at the manner in which it happened, the timing of it, but I was aware of the nature of the contract we'd offered, and the nature of the contract we'd offered permitted that to happen. So if it then happened, we shouldn't be surprised, because that was explicitly a thing that we were prepared to happen, or else we wouldn't have put it as an option in the contract. So the precise timing and sequencing of when it happened, that I think caught everyone a bit on the hop, but that it did happen, I don't think was unpredictable.
What will you miss about him?
The days where he would just produce total magic that would make you go, oh my goodness, putting a car on a road with such precision that just left all the other drivers around him with no option but to sort of surrender to what Lewis was doing on the road. The ability to make a tire last and last and last, even while telling Bono it wouldn't.
he does just a lot of that.
Yeah. The drama that goes along with having him as a teammate, but the delivery of brilliant, brilliant performance. I've said before, I think he's the best racing car driver there's ever been, and I still believe it.
And that's coming from a man who's worked with Michael Schumacher.
Yeah, who another utterly remarkable person, and it's a parlor game that we can all indulge in endlessly without resolution. But if I, gun against the head, had to choose the best person, I would pick Lewis.
Now, you've worked at Ferrari on two occasions. What's Lewis got waiting for him there?
Well, he'll get a sense of the spirit and passion of that team.
Do you think he'll react well to that?
I think it might get tricky. At Ferrari, the Ferrari is the star. I think every driver who's driven there at some level or other has had to come to terms with that. If Lewis actually embraces that and loves it in the way that Michael did, then there's space for both to be great. If he doesn't, then I think the brand and the Ferrari will always, always dominate.
Now, Toto said in Canada that Kimi Antonelli is the team's future. Just wanted to ask you about him, how you feel Kimi's developing.
Well, I'm probably a bit disappointing as a person to answer that question, because I don't have much to do with it. I work on the car, and the driving side of it is dealt with by other people. So Toto and Gwen and some of the folk in the race team who look after looking at him and watching what he does is much, much, much more peripheral to the things that I spend my days doing. However, you know, I can't ignore the fact that he's in our TPC car, the 2022 car, running tests in the car to sort of get himself familiarized with it. And he's pretty bloody good. So it's a nice sort of background feeling for me as I worry about the here and now, which is making the car work, to think that we've got this burgeoning young talent who is gathering his strength and who's headed our way at some point.
He's only 18. Oh, he's going to be 18 at the end of August. He's only 17 at the minute. How big an ask is it to put a guy that young, that raw, in a front-running Formula One team?
It is a huge ask, but I think if the talent is there, it won't matter. You know, when Lewis was first put in a Formula One car, I think a lot of people would have said, that's a huge ask, straight from GP2, I think.
He'd had more experience in the junior formulas.
Yes, but whenever a rookie comes into Formula One, that is a huge ask. And yes, he will be young. And yes, that will put a load of pressures on his young shoulders. But if you look at Ollie Bearman's debut in Saudi, that is a difficult circuit. And he was in that car last minute. And look at the way he performed, the maturity with which he performed. If the driver has the temperament and the skill, they will step up to that ask. And all things point towards Kimi having those things. So yeah, huge ask. But if the talent's there, he will answer it in a way that will make everyone go, blimey.
He'll obviously get the current car initially if the deal happens. But then, of course, we go into 2026. His sophomore season will be with the new regulations. Let's talk about the power unit, everything that's going on at Brixworth. Are you in good shape?
We won't know until we know when we line up against everyone else. I'm lucky enough to be in meetings with Howell and his top guys at HPP, and they're kind enough to share the sort of scope of their ambition and the progress they're making with that engine, I should say, the power unit. They know that 2026 for the power unit is like it was for 2014. They know it will set the fate of the team in large measure for some years to come. And they're all in on making it a success. They put some very, very bold targets down, and they seem to be on track to making them happen. It's, you know, really invigorating watching them do it. But our role in it is more to try and say how it will hook up to the chassis and what part we can play in trying to make it package nicely and organize its cooling and stuff like that. But the main work is happening in HPP.
Right. Well, James, it's been brilliant to have you back on the pod. Thank you. It seems you've got a lot going on. When Mercedes are winning again regularly, will that be the peak of your career?
Well, it'll certainly be massively enjoyable, but I wouldn't really think of it in those terms. If we can get ourselves back to a place where we are genuinely properly competitive across a whole wide range of circuits and we're in the championship battle, I know that the pleasure we will collectively feel will make all the last 3 years, the pain and the self-doubt and the self-loathing in some instances, will make all of that just go away like dew, you know, as the sun comes out. And that's what I think about. I don't think about it in terms of my career. I just think about the pleasure, holding that in my head, the pleasure we're going to collectively feel as a group when we get there.
James, good luck. If I could just end with what is now a regular on the show, didn't do it last time you were on, but our quick fire questions. What else are you good at?
I'm sort of adequately competent across a wide range of things and not particularly good at anything.
Passionate about flying, aren't you?
I like flying little planes. I like making stuff out of wood. I hope I'm an adequate dad, you know, that sort of stuff.
Which racing person, dead or alive, would you like to be stuck in a lift with?
Bob Bell.
Why Bob?
Because I really, really like him.
You've worked with him in the past.
Yeah.
Between the two of you, you'd fix the lift, wouldn't you? James, who would play you in a film?
Some sort of anteater.
Who is the coolest person in your address book?
I don't have a very show busy life, so I'm just going to default to my family. That they're head and shoulders more important to me than anything else, and I love and admire them massively, and I think they are cool as anything.
All right, final one. If you had a podcast like this, who would be your first guest?
You mean a Beyond the Grid podcast?
No, any kind of podcast.
To everybody. This is the second time for me. So
it could be woodwork or planes or whatever else you're interested in.
That feels so hypothetical because I cannot possibly imagine that I would ever want to make a podcast or subject to answering my questions. I have no idea.
You and Toto, I'd love to hear that.
Well, just come down to our garage and see us talking. You'll see how Toto and I interact, and it is a fun thing because he makes me laugh, and he's good fun to be around.
James, thank you very much. Now there's an idea. Toto and James together. What a double act. And James and Bob Bell would be another great podcast, Bob being an aerodynamicist who's worked with James over many years. Well, I thought that was a fascinating conversation. I learned something from James every time we speak, and to pick a highlight from this pod would be too hard because there are many. But his fighting spirit and honesty are what shine so brightly for me. James, thank you for your time and good luck in the coming races. Well, what did you think of that chat with James? Let me know through all the usual means. Use the hashtag F1BeyondTheGrid or I'm at TomClarksonF1. And you've been busy getting in touch since last week's show with Nicholas Tombassis. Many of you gave us your thoughts on the 2026 rules, summed up by this from Tim Wozniacki. F1 has to keep pushing back the boundaries. I love what the sport is doing in 2026, especially with the power units. Well, thanks for that, Tim. But Nicholas's career extends much further than his time at the FIA, and Hamzy Chowdhury added this. It's painful always hearing such big figures of the sport say how Fernando Alonso deserved to win more world championships, including one with Ferrari. Well, Hamzy, first, thanks for getting in touch. And second, maybe the 2026 rule changes will give Fernando his opportunity to win that third world title. Wouldn't that be great? Well, that's almost it for this week. Thank you for your company as ever. One more thing before I go. It's race week, so we're about to find out if Mercedes can take the fight to the likes of Red Bull, Ferrari and McLaren in Barcelona. I asked 1996 world champion Damon Hill what he thinks on F1 Nation's preview of the Spanish Grand Prix, on which we're also joined by Aston Martin performance director Tom McCulloch. That's available on your podcast app now, and there's also a new episode of F1 Explains out too. I will, of course, be back next week with another great guest from the world of Formula One, but for now, F1 Beyond the Grid is produced by Formula One and Audioboom Studios. Until next time, keep it flat out.